smaller and smaller each year. All thanks to you and the Power Hour. During the Power Hour, we'll raise a full day's worth of pledges in 1 hour. That day, we cut down on the length pledge drive. So tune in to the Power Hour, 7 a.m. Thursday, April 11th, and keep pledge drives as small as possible.
Support for today's broadcast come the Prairie Ensemble, whose first concert of the new season is at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, September 28th at University's Christian Church in Champaign. The program features Mahler's Fourth Symphony for Chamber Ensemble, a Mozart Wind Serenade, plus a musical surprise at half. More information is available at 555-9077 or prairieensemble.org.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Ed Williamson and Mardiel. The following program's from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll take you into the lives, the sometimes very dangerous lives, of divers who explore shipwrecks in deep water. And our guest for the program is Robert Curtin. He's the author of a recently published book, which is titled Shadow Divers. It's published by Random House, and it's getting a lot of attention now as people are exploring this story about exploring. Basically, it starts back in 1991, where some divers found the wreck of a World War II German U-boat off the coast of New Jersey. And initially, it was a great puzzle, because no what boat it was. And there were no historians or guns who in fact knew what boat it was. And when the divers and the people who were working with them continued to try to investigate and consult what sort of historic record there was, the records seemed to suggest that there couldn't be a sub there, a sunken German submarine at that location, but it certainly was there. And the book, Shadow Divers, the story about how they came to investigate the wreck and eventually solve that mystery and determine which ship it was. The subtitle of the book is The True Adventure of Two Americans Who Risked Everything to Solve One of the Last Mysteries of World War II. And we'll get the story this morning in this part of the show. Just a little more about our guest, Robert Curtin. He, in the past, has been a features writer for the Chicago Sun-Times and also Chicago Magazine. After that, he moved on to Esquire as a contributing editor. He's also had stories published in Rolling Stone, in the New York Times Magazine, and publications, and makes his home now in the Chicago suburbs. Mr. Curtin, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate it. I guess part of the reason that this story was that you were one of those Chicago area kids, and I guess I was too, who toured the submarine, the U-505 that's on display at the Museum of Science and Industry. So that was, you'd had that experience of walking through that marine, and somehow when you heard a story that someone had discovered another one, that was part of what grabbed you.
Yeah, if you're a kid anywhere who grows up anywhere near Chicago, as you know, one of the annual field trips you make is to the Museum of Science and Industry. And for our classes, we were often given a choice of whether we wanted to see the working coal mine, which featured moving cars and like an explosion in a dark room and everything, or this U-boat from World War II. And the U-boat always fascinated us because it seemed so ominous and deadly and yet so able to slip invisibly on cover of water and rise and terrorize anywhere. So that image stayed in my imagination for most of my life. Years later, when I came up with this story, it awakened these long-dormant memories of this incredibly powerful but stealthy machine.
Well, I guess one of the things about the story that's really interesting is the various personalities that are connected to it, the people, the people who are behind the dive. And the story starts with a man named Bill Nagel, who lived out in that area, had done this kind of work, had done shipwreck exploration, and he apparently met a fisherman who said to him, you know, I've come across this wreck, something that's down in a deep area of the water, and maybe you might want to check it out.
Yes, by all rights, the fisherman who had this location should not have breathed a word to Nagel or to anyone else. These charter fishermen who take paying customer sites depend on the secrecy of their sites, their lifeblood. If they can deliver customers to places in the ocean where the fish are getting onto their poles, their lives are golden. And in this 60 miles off the coast of Point Pleasant, New Jersey, he had the best sight of his life. There were tuna and cod and mackerel willing themselves onto his ship, but something was seemed to be pinging in his instinct that there was some important at the bottom. He knew the fish were gathered around some. That much he could tell because the bottom finder. He had no idea what this was at the bottom of the ocean. Most likely he knew it was a pile of rocks or a worthless barge, but it could have been something different. His curiosity got the best of him, and he went to the only man he knew in the whole state capable of diving to those kind of depths, and that man was a charter boat captain named Bill Nagel, who had built his boat, the Seeker, for one purpose, and that was for the exploration of the most daring and exciting ships in the world.
And what other wrecks had he investigated?
He had been one of the early pioneers on the famous passenger liner Andrea Doria, and in fact had become legend already for recovering the bell from the Andrea Doria. Just that accomplishment alone qualified him as one great wreck diver in the world and a legend in his own time. But he had really lived for exploration, and the Andrea Doria, for all the greatness that it beheld, had already been discovered. Nagel wanted to find something special on his own. So when the fishermen came to him with a set of mystery numbers, that spoke to Nagel.
Hmm. And but this time now, Nagel, he was not dying anymore.
No, he was just beyond the point of being able to dive. From the brilliance of his artistry underwater, he also found himself battling a terrible alcohol problem and had become unable to weather the kinds of pressure and demands that a 230-foot or 250-foot dive into the Atlantic required. This is not anything like the resort air warm water scuba diving that we're all familiar with. This is about the most grueling and most punishing and most unforgiving sport in the world.
Well, that's you did an entire chapter of the book to a discussion of just how dangerous this is, why diving these wrecks is dangerous. And I guess there are a couple of things. One thing that makes it dangerous simply is the depth at which the diver is working. The other thing that makes it very dangerous are the conditions under which the divers work. The wreck itself can be dangerous. Sometimes there can be problems with visibility. So it really is extremely dangerous. People do die doing this. And probably a fair number of people in this country who are recreational scuba divers. The number of people who do this kind of thing, it's not very many.
No, there might be 10 million or so certified scuba divers in the United States. Probably fewer than 200 will dive deep for shipwrecks. And the reasons are exactly as you state. Depth is a terrible danger for a couple reasons. One is that a diver will experience nitrogen narcosis, a fogging of brain's ability to reason properly and to coordinate motor skills and to make judgments. The other is that depth and with time, a deep wreck dive owes what's called a decompression obligation, meaning that if he should find himself in trouble for any reason, he can't simply surface for the sunshine and seagulls, as they say. He must stay underwater and come up slowly, pausing at predetermined stops to allow the nitrogen bubbles in his bloodstream to charge. If he doesn't do so, he'll be hit with a case of the bends, what we know as bends, which can paralyze you or kill you faster than you can blink. So these guys must scream against millions of years of instinct if they're in trouble, and stay underwater and solve any problem that occurs.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Robert Kersen. We're talking about the story that you will find in his recent book. It's called Shadow Divers. It's published by Random House in the bookstore now, if you'd like to look at the book. And also here, questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you explained a little bit about the fact that this all started with a fisherman who felt that there was something there on the bottom that could be interesting. And so he talked with the man that he knew, the only guy, you say, the guy that he knew who could actually explore this, Bill Nagel, who was very famous for diving wrecks. And so he assembled some divers and he went out there. And one of the divers took, and another one of the principals in the story is a man named John Chatterton, who was, I believe, the first diver to down and see the boat. Tell us about him.
John Chatterton took up scuba diving relatively late in life, probably in his mid-20s, which is a late start for a guy who's going to be pushing the depths to the crazy degrees that men did it. He was an ex-Vietnam medic who was legendary in that part of Vietnam for walking point with his patrols, meaning he would only go into combat, which most medics didn't do. But he would walk in the front of the unit in the worst kind of fear and became fabled for his willingness to risk his life to help his men. He was a crazy SOB, but at the same time, one of the brightest, most complex, layered, and introspective men you'll ever meet in your life. he became a deep diver for a variety of reasons. Many have had to do with the artery involved, and which helped him answer questions about what he stood for in life and what he would stand for in the future. He was also, like Nagel, a man of exploration. But unlike Nagel, he was able to make this kind of a deep dive to a mystery number of 230 feet at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
When he was this guy that went down. He came on the wreck. I guess, you know, maybe initially you're not really sure what it is that you're looking at. What was it that tipped him to the fact there, or at least that made him pretty sure that what it was the wreck of a submarine?
Well, David, let me tell you first that Nate and Chatterton had a very hard time assembling skeleton crew for this exploration trip. Nobody believed that there'd be anything important at this part of the ocean, and it cost money to go out there. So the common refrain when they invited people was, the golden age of shipwreck exploration has passed. All the great shipwrecks have been found already. Beyond that, these guys were convinced that they would only find a pile of rocks. They might find, you know, a pipe barge or something. That's what they all believed. So when Chatterton got down there, he expected to find nothing, important at least, and combined with the building psychosis in his brain, he certainly wasn't ready for what he encountered. He got down there, and he looked inside this big metal mat, and he saw a shape. And it was a shape that seemed to him unmistakable. It was a shape from the most frightening movie he'd ever seen. It was the most ominous and dangerous shape he could conceive. It was a torpedo. And yet, he told himself, as he was underwater, I can't be seeing a torpedo. I know everything about the shipwrecks that lie in this area, and there are no submarines within a 100-mile radius of this place. I can't be seeing what I think I'm seeing. He closed his eyes and opened them again, and the torpedo was still there. And as he backed off of the wreck, he started to see things that were built for gliding, not the kind of lines that are built into worthless pipe barges. And he began a two-man dialogue with himself. And he could not talk himself out of what he knew. They'd come upon not just the submarine, but as he inspected the degradation metal and other clues, he knew he was looking at a World War II German U-boat.
It's the way that you created, and I'm assuming that he actually told the story. This was what it was like for me down at the bottom, was that there were these two competing voices, that one was saying, that's a turtle, this is a submarine. And there was another voice that was saying, no, it can't be, because, as I say, everybody, that's what everybody knew. They had a pretty good idea what was around there, and the idea that there'd be a sunk U-boat, German U from World War II, just was not on the page. So he really, that conversation that you're reporting in the book, that he told you, this is what happened to me when I was down there?
Yes, I should tell you, I spent countless hundreds of hours with Chatterton and with Richie Kohler, who will play another important part in this book. And, you know, they recounted it extremely, in extreme detail for me. And that conversation was one of the things that Chatterton remembers most, because he had done so much research about this area. He wasn't just about stumbling up shipwrecks and pulling out artifacts, as many people report are. He was about the beauty of the discovery, and so he had done much research, and he knew it was impossible for a German to be anywhere near here. And yet he understood that this depth, in this kind of dangerous environment, his brain could be playing tricks on him. So this is why this two-man dialogue occurred. As he came up toward the Seeker, the dive boat that Bill Nagel used to bring these divers out there, his mind cleared, and as he was compressing, he no longer needed two-man dialogue. Now he spoke in declaratives to himself. He said, I just found the Holy Grail. That is a German U-boat.
Once they got back up to the surface and was able to tell Nagel what it was they had found, and then some of the other divers went down and they also looked around, everybody obviously agreed that that's what it was, then the question was, well, what boat was it? I guess that it was known that a certain number of U-boats were lost during World War II, and nobody knew what had happened to them. But this, again, we're going back to the fact that didn't make any sense that it was a particular location, because apparently there was nothing in the record to suggest that there should be a sunken U-boat anywhere around there.
Right. Most U-boats, when they were sunk with great cataclysm and violence, usually the result of a battle or depth charges from Allied ships or Allied airplanes. So there was records kept of locations and of sinkings. That's why it was such a surprise that this U-boat could be in part of the ocean. To these guys' memories, there was nothing that had happened in that part of the ocean. And in fact, when they would research it later, they would be proved correct. Nobody ever reported so much as a smoke anywhere near. But the divers were not fazed at all. During the celebration on the return trip, as they were going back home, they thought, well, we'll come back out here in a week or two. We'll go inside the wreck and pull the identity out, and we'll make history. It's as simple as that, one more dive. Little did they know that years later, they would still be battling the submarine, at great cost to themselves, by the way, to solve this mystery.
Yeah. One of the, after that first dive, when they went and they saw what it was, they all agreed among themselves they would say anything, because obviously there's a lot of, there may not be a lot of people who do this work, but among them there is great competition, and this would be a fabulous sort of thing to be able to find and to lay claim and to explore. But it didn't stay secret very long.
No. In the culture of East Coast diving, there are decades-long rivalries, bitter feuds. They will pull knives on the bottom of the ocean to stop another rival from jumping the claim. They are very, very competitive and very much aware that rivals and enemies will stop a thing to steal glory and claim credit for things. And so they were sworn to secrecy, each among themselves. There were 14 men on the boat that night. All of them swore a pact of secrecy that nobody would breathe a word of this, that if anyone asked what they had found this exploration trip, they would say it had been just a pile of rocks and that they'd gone to somewhere else on routine diving. But they were so thrilled with once-in-a-hundred times discovery that the secret lasted about 2 hours where the men couldn't contain themselves and started blabbing it to people.
So how did, now we talked about Nagel, he was the guy that had the boat that was made to do this kind of exploration and had done some of this work, and then the diver John Chatterton, and he was the first to go down and set eyes on it. There was another diver that has an important part in this story, Richie Kohler. Now how does he get involved in the project?
Richie Kohler would have seemed the natural to be on this first trip. Not only was he one of the great divers in the Northeast, wreck divers, but he also was a passionate and brilliant amateur historian with a specialty in German naval warfare. This had been the kind of thing he would have been perfect to go along with, and he was a wonderful exploration diver. But he had a long-standing hatred with John Chatterton. Each of them represented to the other exactly what they hated about the other diver's sensibility. To Chatterton, Kohler was about hauling things out of the wreck, take every last artifact. Kohler was a member of the infamous gang called the Atlantic Divers, who lived to just take as many artifacts out of shipwrecks as possible. Chatterton acknowledged that they were some of the brilliant divers in the world, hated their sensibility, and their Chatterton believed diving should be a beauty and about exploration and about solving mystery. Kohler thought Chatterton to be entirely too stuffy and to be about these high-minded principles that had no business at the bottom of a very dangerous Atlantic. So they hated each other. They had had bad experiences with each other and despised what the other represented. So Kohler was left off this trip, but he would soon find his way on some tragic circumstances.
One of the things you talked about a couple of moments ago is how much competition there is over the right to explore these kinds of wrecks, and the fact that at the bottom of the ocean that people have pulled knives on each other because they were thinking over what there was to be found. What exactly, what are the rules, or are there any rules about if he has discovered something, that mean that they have any kind of exclusivity, any rights of exclusivity to explore that, or is it just fair game for anybody who can get there?
Well, that's a complicated question. There are, when somebody discovers a ship or has valuable cargo aboard, they can go into court, depending on where the wreck is covered, and claim salvage rights. That doesn't happen as often as you'd think, because any of these shipwrecks, what there really is to find is history, rather than, you know, gold or irreplaceable artwork, things like that. So, and Chatterton himself has gotten salvage rights in wrecks he's found. But absent that court maneuver, the shipwreck is pretty much open to whoever is capable of diving it, and that's where you get these incredible underwater rivalries where people think, you don't belong here, I came first, I'm entitled to it. And these bad feelings can last decades.
Well, one of the things we told a bit earlier about the fact that I have gone through, and you have through, and maybe some people who are listening to us this morning have toured the U-505 at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. And if you have, oh, just what a crank space that is. It's really small, and you can get some, you can imagine what it must have been like to be on that boat with the other crew, and there was a crew of about, was it about 30?
56
people trying to live in that contained space. And I'm, and one of the things that John Chatterton did early on was that he went to Chicago and took as many tours through the U-505 as he could just to try to familiarize himself with what that inside of that space had been. That must, for him, that must have been maybe a little bit scary, walking through that, knowing what a tight space it is when it's there, sitting there in mint condition, not having been blown apart and sunk to the bottom of the sea. He must have at that point thought about just how difficult it was going to be to try to negotiate that space on the wreck.
When you go through the U-505 in Chicago, as a tourist, it's almost impossible not to bang your head into something, to get your sleeve caught up on something, to trip over something, and that's in the most safe conditions that you could possibly imagine. What Chatterton's challenge was to get inside a sunken German U-boat that had wire, pipe, conduit, jagged edges splaying in every direction, all of which could catch on the 175 pounds or more of gear that the underwater shipwreck diver carries, and which will mummify you and entomb in less than a moment's notice and just drown you in a second. So Chatterton, just to contemplate going inside this wreck was a phenomenally courageous, maybe even insane thing to do. But when Chatterton went to Chicago, he wasn't just there to get a sense of how tight the shipwreck could be for diving. What he really was looking for was to see in his mind's eye, where would this piece of identification that I see in Chicago fall to if a wreck crumbled in the way that I think the wreck crumbled in New Jersey? How would this plate fall, and where would it be in the silt, if the shipwreck in New Jersey sank the way I think it sank? That's how he thinks. That's his art. And that's what he took back with him from to New Jersey after spending a whole day and several times in line at the U-505 in Chicago.
When they went back to the wreck, what was it that they, you know, you said that they thought that probably all they needed to do was make one more dive, that they could go down there and they could find something that would tell them what boat this was. And as it turned out, it didn't work that way. It didn't take just one dive, and it took them a long time before they could actually find that answer. What did they think, or did they think that there was something specific that they could recover easily, or they could find relatively easily that would tell them what ship this was?
David, they could have made you a list 5 pages long of the things that should have come out of that wreck instantly that would have identified it. They had, both of them, Chatterton and Kohler, had dived on other sunken U-boats, known U-boats off the coast of Rhode Island and other places that were in shallower water, where the moment it was found by divers, yielded a bunch of brass tags with the name of the U-boat on it, yielded other instruments etched with the number of the U-boat. It had been no problem for anyone who had ever found a U-boat. It was a matter of minutes, really. So that's what they were expecting to find. The U-boat wreck that they found was perfectly pristine and intact, but for a gaping wound in the center control room section of the boat. So what the divers understood, as optimistic as they were, was that their U-boat had met a cataclysmic and very violent end, and it had met its end in the center of the ship where most of the identification from other wrecks had come from. So they knew there might be a challenge, but still they were certain that it was just a matter of one more dive to find the answer.
So what was it that was the first thing that they came across that was an important clue?
Well, they first found some plates that had the eagle and swastika in the year 1942 stamped on the back. So they knew that the vintage and the origin, the country of origin of this submarine. That much they were certain of fast. But the first major clue for identification came later in 1991, the year they found this boat, when John Chatterton found a knife engraved, hand-engraved, with the name of a crewman, Horenberg. And when he surfaced with this artifact, everybody on the boat slapped him on the back and celebrated and said, "Congratulations, John, you've solved the mystery. All you need to do is find Horenberg, and we know what boat this is." And Chatterton was very, very optimistic and happy. He told people, "This is the greatest shipwreck artifact I've ever found."
Hmm. So how easy was it? Just as easy as that? All they had to do was consult crew lists for U-boats to find some guy named Horenberg, and then they would know what it was?
That's all they had to do. And the good news was that when Chatterton got home and consulted his sources, he discovered there was only one Horenberg in the entire German Navy, Martin Horenberg. And he had served on a U-boat, and then the confounding part came. Martin Horenberg had died aboard his U-boat off the coast of Gibraltar, 3,650 miles away from New Jersey.
So he couldn't have been on both boats.
He couldn't have been on both boats. It was a devastating blow to Chatterton's research, and the best clue, the best artifact he had ever pulled from a shipwreck turned out to be what seemed like a dead end.
Another of the complicating factors here was that the remains of the German sailors were still in the boat. And apparently for a lot of people, that was an issue, and that they thought that the wreck should be left undisturbed for that reason. How did the divers think about that?
That's a wonderful question, and it goes to the heart of why Chatterton and Kohler are so interesting and special as subjects for a book like this. There was a very good possibility, and by the way, the bones are everywhere in this wreck. Chatterton and Kohler could only describe it at the time, and to me also, as a boneyard, almost like walking at Gettysburg the next day. There are skulls and femurs and other bones everywhere. They could have, according to their research, rummaged through the clothing of these deceased sailors, gone through their pockets, and looked for a lighter engraved with the name of the U-boat or some other identifying information, which could have been and might even likely have been on their persons still. But by this time, Chatterton and Kohler, who were becoming obsessed with solving this mystery, were understanding that their quest was not just about solving this mystery and rewriting a page of history. They were risking their lives and risking their marriages and watching other people die around them. They understood because something deeper was going on inside them. They were really on the start, on the forefront of asking basic questions about who they were as people. And neither of them wanted to ever say the rest of their lives, "I undertook this life-changing challenge at great risk, only to do things the wrong way, to do the wrong thing, and to disturb the dead. Even if it kills me, which it likely could, I'm not going to do this the wrong way and disturb the remains. I'm going to find identification the right way." So they would not disturb the dead or their clothing or their valuables. They just had to do it another way.
In this hour of Focus 5, we're talking with Robert Kersen. He has worked in the past for both the Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Magazine, and then went over to Esquire as a contributing editor. He has also written stories that have appeared in Rolling Stone and New York Times Magazine. His book that tells the story in greater detail than we are covering here about the discovery of this lost German U-boat. The book is titled Shadow Divers, The True Adventure of Two Americans Who Risked Everything to Solve One of the Last Mysteries of World War II. It's published by Random House. It is out in the bookstore now if you'd like to read it. And, of course, questions are welcome, too, if you'd like to call in. 333-955, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked earlier about the dangers of doing this kind of diving, three people were killed during the course of the exploration of this wreck.
Yes. The Andrea Doria, which is one of the most dangerous shipwrecks you can dive in or near America, at the time of the discovery of this U-boat, there had been 36 years and tens of thousands of dives on the Andrea Doria, such a dangerous shipwreck. Six people had died in those 36 years. In the first year alone of diving this U-boat, three men lost their lives, really wonderful, accomplished, smart divers were killed. And that only convinced the divers more that they should stay away from this wreck, that it was a killer, a man-eater, and that it was best left untouched, especially since the only thing that could really come of it was an identification. Many divers left it alone at that point. It was just not worth it. But as I said, Chatterton and Kohler found themselves on an exploration for something much more fundamental than just the solving of a mystery. they were in this to find out about themselves in very basic ways, and so they were willing to continue even against those terrible odds.
Mm-hmm. How did one of the things that they did was, in their effort to try to determine what ship this was, they consulted what kind of records the military had, both here in the United States, but they also went to Germany. How did people in Germany feel about, and I guess that we're going back to this issue of the fact that there were human remains, and that some people would say, well, whatever else this wreck is, it's a tomb, it's a graveyard, and that it ought to be treated with the respect that you would treat any other place where human remains were found. How did people in Germany feel about their exploration and their wanting to determine what ship this was?
Well, some of the people in Germany could scarcely believe that the divers had done what they said they'd done, which is to find a U-boat right off the coast of New Jersey that no one had any clue about in the world. No expert, Navy, historian, or government had any clue. But once they understood that the divers had done what they'd said they'd done, they were next concerned with the treatment of the remains on board. And when they got to understand the character of Chatterton and Kohler, and that that the respect for the dead was so important that Chatterton and Kohler were almost willing to become the dead themselves, then they seemed most grateful for the effort, that Chatterton and Kohler were going to put names on the dead and give closure to the families in Germany. And that was especially important to Kohler, who had grown up with a huge pride in his German heritage, but who was only now understanding just what that meant to him.
We have a caller here to bring in conversation. Let's do that here in Champaign-Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting. But we'll listen offline. Please say something about the engine. Newspaper had a story about a new, for the time, hydrogen peroxide type engine that was supposed to be very quiet. Thanks. Ciao.
Well, okay. Is that something that you know something about, Mr. Kirsten?
Yeah, it's not really the focus of the book, but I'll tell you this, that the U-boats were threatening to dominate the world in the beginning of World War II. There was almost no answer for them. And with a very small force, smaller than people think, it looked like they could change the course of the world. The Allies turned the tides on the U-boats so that by the 1943, the hunters had become the hunted, and U-boats became sitting ducks for Allied ingenuity and the Allied forces. I think what this call is referring to is that at the very, very end of World War II, the Germans had wonderfully innovative submarine technology that threatened to turn the tide yet again. They could overcome a lot of the problems that were sinking most of the U-boats in the world at the time. But the war didn't last that long. Those U-boats were barely launched, and the Allies triumphed, really crushing the U-boat force. By the time the late U-boats sailed, and the one that my divers found was a late-war U-boat, a U-boat crewman had a statistical life expectancy of barely 60 days. That might have changed had these new U-boats come into service, but it never quite got to that.
Well, other questions are welcome. We're moving into about our last 15 minutes of the interview in this hour. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that the men came across was they actually discovered a man who was a crew member of the sunken boat who, though, because he got sick at the last minute, didn't go along on the last voyage of the ship.
So much of the history of this particular U-boat comes to us through that man. Just by the winds of fate, he took ill just before the U-boat sailed and was left behind. He survives to this day, and with his wonderful memory and incredible attention to detail, is able to reconstruct for us in wonderful richness the training and last days of that U-boat.
How did that for the divers? Did that somehow make it all that much more real? They could somehow had a feeling for what the boat was like, and maybe even something about the people who sailed it.
Absolutely. Now, they didn't find this guy until after their quest had finished, but there was no shortage of connection between the divers and the bones that they swam among, they learned and made themselves expert in the history of the U-boat war and were surprised to find out that at the end of the war, when it was very likely that this boat had sailed for New York, that these were largely kids on board, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. The commander of the whole boat was himself 26 and the first officer just 22 years old, and that they were basically being sacrificed by Hitler for no real good reason. As I said, their life expectancy was barely 60 days. If you sailed for the Americas in 1945 on a U-boat, you stood probably less than a 2 in 10 chance of returning home from that one patrol. So that these guys were really, in certain ways, on a suicide mission. And it changed, in certain ways, the way Chatterton and Kohler conceived of the men trapped and who died on board the submarine. At no time did they feel any sympathy for the Nazi cause, as both of them will tell you repeatedly. If we'd been alive then, we would have bombed the hell out of them personally from airplanes or from boats and would have been happy to do it. But the human beings inside this boat, young men who stood no chance and were being sent knowing that they couldn't hope to succeed, touched them in a certain way.
That's very curious and very complicated probably worth thinking about how it is that one could have all those sort of complicated and conflicting feelings. The fact that you would think that you were an American, and that if this had been World War II, you would have been willing to serve, and this was the enemy, and you would have done whatever it would have taken to sink that submarine. And yet, at the same time, maybe working as a diver, there being underwater and going through that wreck and being close to the bones of those German sailors, that you would also feel some kind of comradeship with them. That seems maybe a little hard to understand how you could feel both of those things at the same time.
It's a very complex thing, and it's a very human, I think. And it's what really interested me in this story when I first found it. At first, I thought this might be just a story about the solving of a historical mystery in an exciting adventure. When I met Chatterton and Kohler and realized how complex they were and how layered, that's when it really spoke to me, that this could be a very special story because they understood the distinction that you're referring to, and they appreciated both ends of it. And they weren't willing to say, for example, when somebody called and said, I'll pay $2,000 for a Nazi skull if you bring one up, they said, we don't do that. These were human beings. These are war dead. And Chatterton especially, who had been in Vietnam and saw so many people die for crazy reasons and reasons that were beyond him. He saw these men among him in Vietnam as serving their country first and not serving an ideology. So he understood the various levels at which one can appreciate what the war dead do.
I want to obviously try to be a little bit careful. I don't want to give away, tell people every single detail that's in here, because I'm sure people will be interested in going out and reading the story, particularly people who are interested in World War II or interested in naval matters or interested in diving for whatever reason. They're going to want to go out and read this book. But maybe you could talk a little bit about what it was that finally supplied enough information so that they could say, yes, now we know what submarine this was.
Chatterton and Kohler became so good at their research on land that they began to surpass the world's great historians. They got into archives and into classified documents that hadn't been read since the end of World War II, and they began to read radio intercepts that the 10th Fleet intelligence arm of the Navy made, intercepts of radio communications between the sub that they had found and German control, German headquarters. And it was through the reading of those intercepts that nobody had looked at, including historians who had gotten this whole story wrong, that they solved a mystery that the rest of the world couldn't budge.
One of the things you also talked about was the relationship between particularly these two divers, Richie Kohler and John Chatterton, who'd started out having lots of reason not to like each other much. And that really changed. One of the things that happens over the course of this story is that these two guys develop a very close relationship.
They do. They could not have hated each other more going into this. And by the end, they were finishing each other's sentences. They understood for each other, that this was about asking that central question in life, who am I really, and what kind of person am I? And each of them was going to forever define himself by the way he behaved in pursuit of this mystery. Once each understood that that's what was at stake for the other, they were willing to die for each other, and almost did several times.
So aside from now securing a little bit of their own place in history for having discovered and identified this wreck, what's in it for these divers, or is that pretty much what it is?
That's what it is in the case of a wreck like this. If you go to the Andrea Doria and risk your life, you might come up with some beautiful china or some mosaics, all kinds of bounty. There's no bounty on this wreck. It's just a killer. And the only thing it really offers is an answer to a great historical mystery. Once that mystery was solved, it only was a threat to divers. And so very few people go back to that wreck these days, maybe just a few every year. And even they are smart enough not to go inside it, into the that Chatterton and Kohler spent 6 years of their life.
Mm-hmm. Richie Kohler is no longer diving, is that right?
No, they both, Chatterton and Kohler both continue to push the envelope of diving. Both of them just this weekend went to insanely dangerous wrecks, but neither of them returns very often to the U-boat because they had their answers on the U-boat already, and it was time to move on.
Hmm. What other kinds of things are they? Have they been involved in?
They continue to look for reports that fishermen make about mysterious masses at the bottom of the ocean, and they also continue to pursue great historical questions. Kohler's in search of another U-boat right now, and Chatterton has been spending much of his time in the last year, year and a half, as host of Deep Sea Detectives, which is an hour-long show on the History Channel, where he and others go in search of different shipwrecks every week all over the world. So diving remains a central focus of their life, but as both of them will readily tell you, they'll never have another experience like the U-boat presented to them.
Hmm. We have probably about 5 or 6 minutes left in this part of the program. I guess I just want to make sure that if people who are listening, if you have a question, it's your opportunity to call, talk with our guest, Robert Kersen. The book is titled Shadow Divers, The True Adventure of Two Americans Who Risked Everything to Solve One of the Last Mysteries of World War II. The book is out in the bookstore now, and it is published by Random House. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. How many other are there other U-boats where you talked about how one of these guys was involved in another kind of similar project? Are there many others that are known to have sunk, and they know pretty much where it is that they are, so that at least they would know where to go looking?
Yes, that's exactly the case. If Kohler goes looking for another U-boat, he knows which U-boat he's looking for. He knows the vicinity in which it was sunk, and it's just a matter of finding it. The difference with the U-boat I wrote about is that no one had any clue that there was a U-boat there, and in fact, all of the world insisted there simply could not be a U-boat anywhere near that location. That kind of a situation is once in many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. So, and just going back to that question of why it is that nobody knew that it was there, the information that it took to answer the question did exist somewhere. It's just that no one had ever actually taken the time to, in a very dedicated sort of plodding way, go through what the record that did exist.
It was so conclusively stated by all the history books that things had happened another way, that it wouldn't have made sense for anybody to think otherwise. There was seemed to be conclusive bulletproof evidence that the particular boat they found had it sunk, 3,650 miles away. It was only through this process of grueling, detailed examination that Chatterton and Kohler subjected themselves to that they found themselves in a position to question history. Every time they came up with what seemed like the answer to the mystery, they found that the history books had it another way. And so they were forced to start asking themselves, could it be that the history books might be wrong about things? to them, these are guys who hold down full-time jobs during the week and who love history and respect the immutability of history books. The idea that written history, especially by some of the most accomplished experts in the world, could be wrong, it was unthinkable. It was heresy. But once it started to dawn on them that maybe written history could be fallible, that's when they started to look at things that the greatest historians wouldn't think to look at.
So I understand that you have sold, or somebody has sold, the movie rights for this. Is that right?
That's right. 2 weeks ago, yeah, to Fox 2000 Pictures.
So you think someday Shadow Divers will be a movie?
I think it makes for a natural movie. It's an incredibly exciting adventure. Just the underwater daring of these two men. Still, it astounds me, even nearly 3 years after I met these guys for the first time. It's unthinkable that they did what they did in the water. But even beyond that, the bonding and friendship, if you saw these guys today, the love they have for each other is really something to behold. And the idea that two ordinary guys could solve this mystery that nobody else in the world could move is incredible. So I think it's a natural on a bunch of levels for a movie.
Yeah. And at significant personal cost to them, too. And obviously they managed to survive the effort, unlike some of the other people that had dived with them. But it certainly left a mark on their lives.
Yes, they both lost their marriages. They both nearly lost their lives many times. It strained friendships. It, at certain times, threatened to strain their emotional stability. Each of them was obsessed with solving this mystery. And there was a time when neither of them thought they could survive it, even emotionally. So it was a great cost to them. But proof further that this was about the most fundamental question you could ask in your life.
Hmm. Well, it's a fascinating story, and I'm sure you feel fortunate to have come across the story and have the opportunity to tell it, because I think probably stories like this are not that common, and for a journalist to find something like this, I'm sure for you it was also an exciting thing, knowing that you had your hands on this kind of story and that you had the opportunity to tell it.
Now, I felt about the discovery of this story the way Chatterton and Kohler felt about the discovery of a U-boat. One many lifetimes, and I had to do everything in the world possible to be great on my end, to live up to what they did on their end. And I learned a lot from learning their story and about what it means to do something great, and I'm proud of the book in that respect, that I think it lives up to the example that they set.
Well, I guess at that, it would be a good place for us to finish with our thanks to Robert Kersen. And if you want to read this book, it is entitled Shadow Divers. The subtitle is The True Adventure of Two Americans Who Risked Everything to Solve One of the Last Mysteries of World War II. It's published by Random House. We had someone call in and ask the question, is it available on tape or on CD? And the answer is yes.
Yes, both.
Yes, it is, both ways. So if someone would like to actually listen to it that way, you could do that, or I'm sure you could go down to the bookstore and you could find the book, and it's a good read. And Mr. Kersen, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks. It's my great pleasure to be on with you.
Our guest, Robert Kersen, is a contributing editor at Esquire magazine, also former writer for the Chicago Sun-Times and also Chicago Magazine. He makes his home up in the Chicago suburbs. And again, if you want to read the book, it's out there in the bookstore now. It's titled Shadow Divers, and Random House is the publisher. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm Inge for tuning in.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Bodywork Associates now has an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union.
It's 3 minutes before 12 noon, and this is coming up, the Afternoon Magazine with Tom Rogers in for Celeste Quinn this afternoon. We have our hour-long look at news and features from NPR and the BBC and AM 580 coming up in the noon hour. Then following that at 1 o'clock, we'll be hearing an interview with Kimberly Cronick, a guest host for the Afternoon Magazine. She'll be talking with Byron Katie. He is founder of The Work, and he's a self-help facilitator and the author of a book called A Thousand Names for Joy, Living in Harmony with the Way Things Are. That's our subject for the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine with Kimberly Cronick filling in for Celeste. Let's take a look at how the markets are doing at the moment. And as far as wheat and beans are concerned, big upticks again today, mainly with the wheat on some strong export numbers, and generally the shape of the U.S. dollar making the wheat and bean contracts a little more valuable for people. But in the meantime, a 16.75 cent gain on the December wheat contract in Kansas City. It's trading right now at $8.90 a bushel. In Chicago on the Board of Trade, December wheat is at 903.5 a bushel, up 16.25. The March contract is at 906, up 14ths. Corn pit right now is not really following beans and wheat. It's marginally up at the moment. The nearby December corn contract is at 373 a bushel. That's up a penny and a quarter. March is up one at 388.5. May corn is at 397.75, up 1.5 cents. November beans are up 15.5 cents right now at 988.5. That's the only contract that's not above the $10 mark at the moment. January beans for next year are trading at 1004, 1004.5 now at 15.5 cents. And March of next year's beans at 1013 a bushel, up 16.25. In the products, October soybean meal is at $277.50, up $6.10, and October bean oil is at $38.78, up $14. On the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, September feeder cattle are at $115.90 at the moment, up 7.5, and October lean hogs are down 70 at $60.30. Crude oil in New York trading below $80 a barrel again. It's down 48 cents right now from yesterday's close at $79.04.